This is the Gerald Schmidt Memorial Lecture, Rocky Mountain Conference of Parasitologists, held at Cedar Point Biological Station on September 19, 2008. I'd like to begin with a few really casual comments about tradition. You are actually sitting in the room where the first field parasitology class was ever taught. You're sitting in the room where Gerald Schmidt actually taught a day of field parasit. What you're looking at over here behind Matt is the field parasit locker from last summer that we didn't clean out and should have. So this particular room is really steeped in tradition. In addition, in order to put together the pictures for the comments I want to make, I had to go back into the 2x2 slide archives, which Katie Potter had two gigantic books full of them, and that brought back a lot of memories. And of course, I didn't really have time. And I've tried to digitize 2x2 slides before, and they never really turn out quite like you want them. So I thought maybe I'd give you as authentic an old-time nostalgic experience as you can have. For some of you, this may be the first 2x2 slideshow you've ever seen in your life. And for most of you who are not down here, there were a bunch of students taking pictures of this thing and putting their faces down beside the carousel projector, almost as if it were an object from outer space. So. Well, thank you very, very much. It's a real honor to be asked to deliver this this talk this evening, particularly since I've delivered so many talks in this particular room. Now, this one is very, very unusual simply because of the honor and because of the people here and because of the stuff that I really want to say, which is some rather rampant idealism about American higher education, but with some examples to be shown. So, Kristen, if we can start the first slide. Yeah, part of the, or the next slide, please. Part of the part of the authenticity is you're going to hear me say, Kristen, next slide. So, this facility was built originally as a Girl Scout camp on land donated by the Gainsforth family, and the buildings themselves were paid for by a woman named Clarissa Goodall. The Girl Scouts ran it for a while. They ran into all kinds of management difficulties. They quit using the facility for a variety of reasons. It was then used as a church camp quite unsuccessfully, and then it sat idle for a couple of years, and I believe that the Gainsforths were ready to bulldoze it into the lake when a University of Nebraska student who had been in on some of the conversations that Brent and I and another gentleman by the name of Gary Hergenrader had been having saw it. He was out here on a field trip, saw it, told Gary Hergenrader about it. Gary was the interim director of the newly formed School of Biological Sciences at the time. Gary came out and visited the place and visited with the Gainsforth, and that ended up with a five-year lease on the 33 acres. And Brent Nickel, a parasitologist, being then appointed as the first director. And so one of the things I'd like to do is talk a little bit about some of the traditions that Brent established, traditions really that tell us a lot, that teach us some lessons about human resource management, especially in higher education. So next slide, please. One of the first things that Brent did was ask various, fairly famous individuals to come on out here and spend a week. And Brent was a very skillful fiscal manager and managed to have enough excess funds to pay some of these people $1,000 and bring them in. Well, this is Gerald Schmidt in the yellow shirt. He was actually talking with some students in 1976. Either 75 or 76. This is a man named Jim Glime. So this may have been the very first year of our operation, but I think it was 1976 instead. Gerald came out as a visiting scientist And one of the first things he did was walk right in here to the diversion dam, and within 2 minutes had caught the biggest trout anybody had ever seen. He was absolutely a superb fisherman. And the next thing he did was, as we were driving down a road over by Paxton with the students, we stopped, and he poked a pellet pistol out the window and killed a meadow lark instantly off of the electric wires that must have been 100, 200 feet away. And I thought, oh my gosh, somebody can shoot like that and fish like that. This man is dangerous. But he came back and sat right here at a table and slowly, in front of all these students, began dismantling that metal art from the feathers out down to the inside. And to watch Gerald Schmidt go through an animal, the audience became more and more quiet as he proceeded and find a parasite here, parasite there. And I do remember when he started peeling back the layers of the proventriculus and found the nematodes underneath, and that was sort of the crowning blow to that. And I simply have never forgotten the spell that parasitology had over the way that parasitology was able to simply capture the fascination of that group of young students when in the hands of an expert. Next picture. This is Ray Damien, like Gerald Schmidt, a H.B. Ward medalist. Ray is the individual whose medal-winning work was really involved the schistosome imitation of host antigen as protective device. And here's Ray doing exactly the same thing that all our students do periodically, out looking for mosquitoes or snails or something of the sort, wearing, incidentally, a Cedar Point t-shirt that was the first design designed by a student out here. And I don't remember her name, but this is actually this. When you look at that t-shirt, and Katie has some of these upstairs, but if you look at that t-shirt, this bluff is the scene that you see right out here, and these rays then are the sunrise. And if you get up tomorrow morning early and it's not completely cloudy, you'll see that original t-shirt design that we all saw every morning. So this is Ray Damien. Next slide, please. This is Robert Pennack. For those of you who have ever taken an invertebrate zoology course or looked at Pennack's freshwater invertebrates in the United States, this is Robert Pennack. This is Steve Knight, one of my graduate students, out watching in awe as Pennack does what he does best, namely take notes and give us a little bit of a lesson on microcrustacea. I've forgotten where this was. I think, actually, I'm fairly convinced that this is out in one of the toe grains up by the dam before the power district cut down all these trees after 9/11 because they thought they would be good places for terrorists to hide and bomb the dam. Next slide. Brent also established very strongly and very clearly the tradition of meaningful interaction with the local community, and that didn't necessarily, well, that doesn't mean only buying groceries at the grocery store. That means having some kind, using your interpersonal skills to establish the fact that, first of all, you are a human being. Secondly, you are deeply engaged with the non-university people around you. So Brent, being Brent, decided to coach a Little League team. And so there he is, being a Little League coach. And I will say that Brent also managed to beat John McCain to the punch by 32 years. Next slide, please. By hiring a little girl as his fireball pitcher on the boys' team. this one is now the enterprise editor for ESPN.com and handles all of the long-form journalism on that website and has just won an Emmy. And that lesson alone sort of reminds you of something that all of us at the university, all the parasitologists at least, at the University of Nebraska have known and known well, and that is you can never anticipate just by looking at somebody their eventual future and their worth to society and what they're going to become. And I think if there's any lesson that has come out of being a parasitologist and teaching at Cedar Point and being associated with people at the University of Nebraska, it's that your most dependable, your most reliable, your most important research walks or resource walks into your university by the thousands every August and September, and it's your responsibility to yourself as well as to society to make sure that those resources are developed in ways that operate to everybody's satisfaction. Next slide, please. Brent also conducted the first doctoral dissertation exam, final oral exam, and this is Richard Buckner, and I think that's John Lynch, and this is Richard, the victim, the student. You're also seeing a bunch of Coke cans there. This was before the university went Pepsi bonkers, so it was legal to have probably Coke in the pop machine. It's not legal to have Coke. It's a violation of our contract, as far as I understand, to have any Coke products officially on site, so everybody brings their own. So, at any rate, it's right upstairs. The furniture you're seeing, the benches here, I think, are pretty much long gone. There are a bunch of them on the porch outside the new resource building, which is the building over there. These are made out of ammo crates. So the Gaines Force, when they built the Girl Scout camp, they made the tables. These tables were Army surplus, and these benches are all made out of ammo crates. And if you've been in the field of artillery, you recognize those imprints very, very well. And all this furniture was all Army surplus, and it's all long gone. The library here. The first big chunk of library was bought with a $30,000 grant obtained by Brent, a Center of Excellence grant, and in that are some of the original Yamaguchis, which are very, very valuable now. So a lot of firsts and a lot of sort of this is what a mini university in the middle of Western Nebraska ought to be like. Next slide. He established the tradition that everybody would work, and everybody would work in the kitchen. And I do remember at times hearing criticism of Brent because he would be out on the loading dock cleaning up or hosing out garbage cans before we had the dumpster, that sort of stuff. But you figure out in a hurry once you become responsible for these kinds of programs that the job has to be done, and if somebody else will do it, fine. If they won't, then you need to do it. So Brent established the tradition that people would work, including faculty children. This is a faculty grad, but this is also a student. And students came out, for those of you new students. Well, for you Cedar Point alums who are here, I'll remind you that there were years and years and years when students took two courses, 8 credits, and worked 10 hours a week in the kitchen and loved it and made A's. So that rumor needs to go back to city campus. Next slide, please. A bunch of faculty brats grew up out here. The tradition of faculty children being welcome is one that was established early on and established by Brent. This is a birthday party. I've forgotten whose it was. But whose?
John.
Oh, this is John. This is our son's birthday party? Well, happy birthday, John. This is, what, 34 years later. This kid is now a faculty member at the University of Nebraska Medical School and came back last summer to teach a course in epidemiology, and it was a blast, a big-time hit, and he will probably, and this is Devin Nickel, Dr. Nickel's son, and he will likely be back, we all hope, next year. So these are some of the traditions. Next slide, please. One of the things we learned really very early on, and that was the value of the extreme beauty that is Western Nebraska. And it's a subtle beauty, but it's striking, and it gets under your skin very, very quickly. This is Arapaho Prairie, and I don't remember. It's 2 square miles of Sandals Prairie, 26 miles north of here. I think it's still owned by the Nature Conservancy, but it's managed by us. And Brent had a significant hand in the negotiation of the acquisition of Arapaho Prairie. Next slide, please. These kinds of sunsets are fairly routine, and when we're out here, somebody always keeps a watch out that window right there. Classes at Cedar Point run from 8 in the morning usually until 10:30 at night, except on Fridays. But we take a break for sunsets and for big pictures picture ops. Next slide, please. The true beauty of places like the headwaters of Whitetail Creek, and this is a place where our students have done a lot of work. Next one. The various views of Keystone Lake, the lake that's right out in front of us. And if you get up, if you're here for any length of time and you look at Keystone Lake under various atmospheric conditions and from various places, either out in the lake or right up close, suddenly you begin to learn the value of looking at a particular scene from many different perspectives and many different under many different kinds of conditions. And you find yourself learning from that part of nature in a way that you never would. Next slide, please. This is another view of Keystone Lake from out in the far side, looking back toward Cedar Point. So this whole idea that you can look at nature in many ways, from the molecular to the whole organism to the evolutionary to the ecological, you can look at it over time, you can look at it over varying spaces at various scales. The multiple vision of nature, I think, is the parasitologist's burden as well as the parasitologist's power. And every parasitologist that I know of, and I think maybe the discipline tends to force this trait upon us, and I'm not sure we would... I've never figured out whether we would not be parasitologists if we couldn't look at nature that way, or whether by deciding we're going to be parasitologists we get tricked into looking at nature from multiple perspectives. But just the light over Keystone Lake over the course of a year will teach you that lesson. Next one. Same thing with the South Platte River, highly variable. Next one. And this is a highly parasitological view of the South Platte River. It's the same place that you just saw before, but looking at your feet and seeing parasite life cycles going instead of necessarily Department of Water Resources gauging station values. Next one. That's another, just simply, well, that's actually a research place where I seined fish for 14 years. Next one. Nevin's Ranch, this is an example of the continuation of the meaningful interactions with local landowners. This is Sillison property. You saw Matt acknowledge several of the Sillison family in several of his slides. This is a place out north of Paxton that's been a routine spot for not only thesis research but also regular classroom activities in several different courses. As a result, we've tried to, at least some of us have tried to honor those landowners by naming parasite species after them. And there is a Gregorian out of a leech named Metamaris sillisonorum that's named after the Sillison family. And it was with a great deal of interest that I simply took some of the reprints from that and went up to the Sillison household and handed them to them here, and they were thrilled. We think they were thrilled. Next one, please. This is Dunwoody Pond. Both Nevin's Ranch and Dunwoody Pond are places where, like I say, for 25 or 30 years, we have had regular class. And not only, well, and the living organisms there have been the study material for dozens and dozens and dozens of students, including not only master's students, but undergraduate honors thesis students and doctoral students. So for a rancher to say, sure, come on, use my pond whenever you want to, the place is open, just come do it, that's the rough equivalent of supplying a laboratory to the university and all of the living material in it, all in its living in its proper ecological context, free. I mean, all you have to do is drive up there. So the acts of generosity that have been exhibited by the local landowners as a result of really the establishment by Brent Nickel, beginning with coaching Little League, that tradition of making meaningful social interactions with your neighbors, That has really opened up about 300, maybe 400 square miles of private property that we tend to use regularly, probably 150 square miles of it alone in the Haythorne Land and Cattle Company property. Next slide. Oh, this is a gentleman some of you know named Mike Barger. This is perhaps the only picture in existence. Well, no, I was going to say it's the only picture in existence of Mike without his hat on. And the next picture is, if I could have the next slide. This is also a picture of Mike, but with his hat on. I'm pretty sure this is Mike. Yeah. This begins a series of illustrations of students who were recruited into the parasitology program here directly from the freshman zoology class, directly, as opposed to what happens in the formal advising centers nowadays, where people say, oh, don't take it, don't go out there, don't do this, don't do that, don't do such and such. Now, you're not quite ready for that. Baloney. You know, I think one of the things that the parasitologists learn very quickly, again, going back to this idea that this massive body of human resources walks in your door, very intelligent, very perceptive, 18, 19-year-old children, is that you go after the good ones and you try to bring them into the fold immediately. And Mike was a kid who, I say kid, he was recruited right out of freshman zoology. He came out here. We talked a little bit about a class project. Every student in field parasit has to do a class project. He lasted about 3 days on his and came to me and said, this is not difficult enough. Find me a hard problem. So I said, okay. The life cycle of Rhabdochona canadensis. Okay, this is a nematode that lives in fish. And we talked about some ideas, and 4 weeks later, Mike had about 80% solved it. He came back to the university, got a Howard Hughes fellowship, finished up that work, commuting between here and the upper end of Lake McConaughey to get his fish in the red shiners. And ended up publishing it. He was one of the first, one of the few, and one of the first undergraduates to publish his honors thesis. But again, the idea of a freshman coming in here and saying, I want a more difficult problem, is something I've never forgotten. Next one. This is Tammy Percival, who ended up being a subject in one of the books that I wrote. She's now married. Her name is Tammy Percival Cook. Now doing her master's thesis research, she's an example of a number of undergraduates who have stayed on to get their master's degrees and then gone elsewhere for PhDs, or they've gone elsewhere for a master's degree and come back here for a PhD in parasitology. And Tammy was one of those that actually stayed to get her master's degree here. And here she is at work. Next slide. This is one of her research animals, Analogmus civili. This is one that she had tattooed on her shoulder. Next one. That didn't even ring a bell. Tattoo your research animal on your shoulder.
In those days, people didn't get tattoos.
Oh, they didn't get tattoos.
Now they all have
tattoos. Oh, okay. I'm sorry. I didn't realize that. Yeah, I did realize that. But they have tattoos in places you don't normally say, oh, I like your tattoo. This is a picture. This is Tammy with her main research equipment. This is Dwayne Dunwoody. This is Dunwoody Pond. This is the type locality of Steganorhynchus dunwoodii, a species of Gregorin that was actually named in honor of this gentleman here for allowing us to go on his land over and over and over again whenever we want to. So you're seeing the scientist who did the description, the main piece of collecting equipment, the honorific, and the type locality all in one picture. And for some reason or another, this picture really just almost says it all to me. Next one. This is a person you recognize, Rich Clopton, who in a freshman zoology course said to me, when we got to insects, he said, this is the worst teaching collection I've ever seen in my life. I said, okay, Rich, and I happened to be director at the time of this program. I said, I'll trade you 10 weeks room and board, and I'll buy you all this stuff if you'll make a teaching collection. And so Rich spent that summer making the most superb teaching collection in boxes with cotton and laid out. And we talked a little bit about how some of those insects should be displayed. And they were all labeled properly and identified on the back. And that, to my knowledge, some of that collection is still in use. It was absolutely amazing to do that. And for example, for a student in an introductory course to say to the faculty member, this is just terrible material. Nobody has said that. Well, actually, I've had one other student say that to me in the middle of the Vietnam War. I was lecturing on genetics, and she just stood up in the middle of that lecture and said, this is the most boring lecture I've ever heard in my life. My brother just got killed in Vietnam, and we need to be doing something different, like choreographing a dance to mitosis. And the whole room sort of fell silent after that. Well, the next week, here came this film from a friend of mine of a group of students at UCLA who had choreographed a dance on protein synthesis. And you watched this dance, and it was, some of you may have seen this, and it was photographed from the, it was absolutely amazing. You know, so I showed that film, said, here you are, it's the best we can do. Next slide, please. Some of Rich's research animals. So we go from a freshman zoology student deciding to trade 10 weeks of room and board for a teaching collection to the author of the Septate Gregorian chapter in the Illustrated Guide. So this is a pretty substantial leap. Next one. And this is the diagram drawn by his own hand. You saw the one on Lydiana migratoria earlier that was also a work of art. But this one I preempted and put into Foundations, and you'll see this drawing. Rich drew that one. Next one. This is Megan Collins. We stopped and took a look at the place where Beckius Pond was. Megan was also really an individual who was simply driven to do a superb undergraduate honors thesis, and came into the lab and came to Cedar Point as an undergraduate and worked on enchirocephaline monogenoids. There you go, Delaney.
Thank you.
You're welcome. On centrarchid fishes and their host specificity in different ponds in Nebraska, and that eventually got published. And she won the with that same paper. She won the student paper competition at the Southeastern meetings one year. She went down to Bill Font's lab and got her master's degree, and was working on a PhD at another institution when her boyfriend was killed in a bicycle accident, and that sort of changed her life around. She's now a teacher in Omaha. Next. This is Ann Adams. There was a time when faculty members at the University of Nebraska, a large institution, were expected. Yes. She does not look happy. And yeah, you're looking at me. We're actually editing her thesis. This was a time when faculty members at the University of Nebraska were all involved in the freshman program, all of us. Tenured faculty members, senior faculty members. Nowadays, there are very, very few, and our serious mainline introductory courses are being taught mostly by temporaries or other kinds of people who really, and I'm not sure, would have done what we did back in those days. And that was, when asked to go to the advising center during pre-registration, sit down there for a couple hours a week and actually advise students. So I'm sitting down there, and here comes Ann Adams, and this is a quote. I'm a major in electrical engineering, and my mother wants me to go to med school, and all I ever really wanted to do was watch whales. And that's essentially a quote. I said, okay, you need to go to Cedar Point and study parasites. So I figured that study parasites, to see your point, was really not much different. You know, just thrown into this mix from med school, electrical engineering, and studying whales. So Ann came down here, and because we had been working on the myxozoan parasites of Fundulus is a brinus, and every fish that we cut, we had Steve Knight and I, who were doing this work, would say, look at all these other parasites, look at these monogenes, look at these trichodionids, look at this, all this other stuff in here. Somebody ought to be working on this. And so when Ann came along, here was a sucker that we were able to convince into doing this. And so Ann was really the first one to study and actually get a master's degree working on the parasite community dynamics of the parasite community and Fundulus is a brinus. Here we are going over her thesis, and she's not very happy about it. Ann went on to get a PhD at the University of Washington under Robert Rausch, and she ended up on various fishing boats working on seals, which is about as close to whales as I could get her. And she is now a director of a federal of a FDA lab in Kansas City. Next one. This is Wes Shoup. May have published the first undergraduate paper in parasitology at Cedar Point in 1976. You cut up Nemadophorus cyclineatus, the cyclined race runner, and eventually found an extra-intestinal Porcaristica bivitellobata tapeworm, and documented that very, very well, and may have found two or three of those and wrote that up as a research note. The thing I remember most about Wes is that he was denied admission to the University of Nebraska because of the individual he wanted to work with. And that was one of the real lessons. Not, he didn't want to work with a parasitologist. He wanted to work with another individual who was an invertebrate zoologist. And I remember those discussions and the people who brought that discussion forward, that he simply should not be admitted because of his choice of major advisor. And he went on to LSU and I think worked for Ken Corkum. He did founding work on Elaria and ended up at Merck and is very, very successful if he's not retired by now. Next one. Mike Fertig, sitting on the first row of Hensley Hall as a freshman zoology student, came to me and said, I'm kind of curious. I'm not sure I want to go to med school. I said, go to Cedar Point. Mike... Mike's from Bennington, Nebraska. Stayed and got his master's degree working on morphological variation between Salsagynus utanensis, which is a species that he described, a monogene from Fundulus sciaticus, the plains killifish. There had been some research on Fundulus sciaticus by a faculty member at the University of Nebraska at Omaha, showing that you could predict collection site because these fish tended to live in fairly isolated pockets, geographically isolated, disjunct populations, that you could predict where those fish had been collected by certain sets of measurements. So I thought, okay, you ought to be able to do the same thing with the monogenes, maybe. So Mike did that, and that work eventually got published. Mike went to the University of Wisconsin at Madison, worked for Bruce Christensen. Mike is about this big and weighs about 250 pounds. He was dissecting mosquitoes like a champion. He is now a faculty member at Notre Dame University, one of the world's leading experts in proteomics, working on plasmodium, drug-resistant, millions of dollars of grant money. Came out of the large auditorium, recruited as a freshman. Next. Sitting next to Mike, also in that same auditorium, is Mary Ann McDowell, shown here dismantling a snapping turtle. Mary Ann was one of those students who was so bright, I remember she used to finish my sentences before I could get them finished. And she actually stayed, also came out to Cedar Point very early in her undergraduate career, stayed to get a master's degree, testing some purely theoretical ideas about parasite community ecology using Pimophales, the fathead minnow. And she then went to University of Wisconsin to be an immunologist. And she is now also Mrs. Mike Fertig, or maybe Mike is Mr. Mary Ann McDowell. I don't know how that works. But Mary Ann is also works on leishmania, tropical diseases, millions of dollars of grant money. Those two are very successful scientists, both of them coming out of freshman zoology, recruited into the Cedar Point program to study parasites. Next one, Jill Detweiler. Jill also is recruited out of the freshman biodiversity class because of her grades and her performance and writing. And her reaction was, I can't come to Cedar Point because I have to practice the piano. She was a double major in piano performance and biology. And I said, okay, will you come if we buy you a piano? And she said, maybe. So I took $50 out of my pocket, put it in an envelope, and I handed it to Mary Batterson, who was the associate director of Cedar Point at the time. Mary took out another $20, $25, put it in the envelope. We started passing it around to various people. Next thing we know, we had $500 cash, and we bought that piano that's sitting upstairs right now, and it was delivered out to Cedar Point, so that Jill had her piano and no excuse not to come. She is now finishing her PhD at Purdue with Dennis Mancella, and working on evolution and echinostomes. Next one. Tim Runke, probably as a sophomore. For those of you who are at your first scientific meeting, I show you this one because this was Tim's first scientific meeting. Also recruited out of the freshman zoology class. Sitting here, this is the Southwestern Association meetings at Lake Texoma. This is Teague Self, my doctoral major advisor, expert in pentastomes. And Tim is sitting there talking to Teague Self. Tim went to meetings exactly like these first meetings, and when we got in the van at Southern Oklahoma to drive home, first thing he said to me was, I can do that. I can do that. And I said, sure, Tim, I know you can do it. He said, I can do that. And it wasn't very long after that he was, in fact, doing that. And Tim ended up getting his master's degree at Nebraska, went on to PhD at the University of Connecticut with Janine Kyra, and he is a well-published National Student Paper Competition winner and a faculty member at West Virginia State. Next one. That's more Tim. I'm sorry. Keep going. Next. Lee Harden, this is the individual I was telling some of you about earlier, again recruited out of the lower division courses to come to Cedar Point. Went fishing at Beckius Pond, caught a big bass, brought it back to the lab, cut open the bass, it had a 1-inch toad in it, cut open the toad, found a tapeworm inside the toad, and decided that he really needed to study toad tapeworms. And so this is a magnificent and very clean master's thesis. They got published instantly, and Lee went on then to join the military and went to medical school, and he is now a physician. Next one. Scott Snyder. Well-traveled, heavily granted kid here. He is now an NSF program officer, in fact, again, recruited
out of... Only for a year.
Scott was one of those, in fact, that's probably out of Dunwoody Pond. Scott was one of those who went off to another university, to Wake Forest, and got his master's degree and came back for a PhD. And his PhD work really started the cycle of individuals who are now represented by Matt Bowick and Gabe Langford, and to somewhat lesser extent by Lane Knives, the people who worked directly on life cycle evolution and this combination of things. Next slide. Bill Mosier, a student from East High. Here he happens to be in Mexico, but Bill also came out here from the lower division courses. First thing that happened was we found a leech. He became fascinated with leeches, and then he collected some more leeches, and next thing we knew, he was coming back out to Cedar Point to collect leeches. Next thing we knew, he had published some papers on leeches. Next thing we knew, he had gone to Toronto to work for Sherwin Descher on leech biology and anatomy. And he is now a kid who became enamored with leeches. He is now the the curator of worms at the Smithsonian. Next one. Chris Hackenkamp, similarly recruited out of the freshman program. I can't afford to go to Cedar Point, and I said, I'll make you a deal, Chris. If you will catalog the library, I'll give you 10 weeks of room and board. And so that was a trade. And so the library up there has, in the last few years at least, has been, again, extensively cataloged and computerized and entered into the university's database. But Chris Hackenkamp was the one who actually came out and put all of the Library of Congress tags on all of the journals up there and all of the monographs and put them in the right place for room and board, just like Rich Clompton. Next one. This is Raylene Mitchler, again recruited out of the freshman zoology class. And the main reason I show this picture is because I want to show the next one. Next picture. Oh, here she is out working on her thesis. She's actually the first thesis who worked on Gregorians out here. And I think it's the next picture. This particular beetle, this single individual beetle, not the species, but this single individual beetle is actually mostly responsible for all of the Gregorian work that all of our students have done out here at Cedar Point. That first year when Raylene was out here, she caught this beetle, and it was kind of cooperative, and so she named it Herkimer. And that name has kind of stuck, Herkimer beetles, with people who know Raylene. And she let it crawl around on her shirt and all this stuff. And eventually when it came time, she cut it open. And what she found were those enormous stylocephalid Gregorians, some of the ones that Rich talked about earlier today, and immediately became intrigued with those. And so we talked a little bit about what kinds of things might be doable, and she actually did her master's thesis on a couple of different species of grasshoppers and their Gregorians. And among the work that I found particularly fascinating there was, in order to put some of this Gregorian biology into context, she decided she was going to do a time budget on these grasshoppers. What do they really spend their time doing? And the answer is they spend about 90% of their time just resting, doing nothing. And most of the rest of the time they spend cleaning off their legs. And they really don't spend much time eating. So no matter how pesty they may be, they're really pretty lazy. But this is the beetle that started the Gregorian work here. Next one. This is Sarah Richardson, whose mother and father Karen and I know reasonably well and have known. And as a result of that social encounter, Sarah's mother suggested to her that she come out here and do research. And so she came out here, and first thing we did was cut open some damselflies. And two summers later, Sarah finally, we figured out how to get oocysts out of damselflies, adult damselflies, and when those first oocysts then dehiss into, gametocysts dehiss into oocysts, it was about 1 o'clock in the middle of in the morning, some weeknight, and she woke me up, and we went into town and got some microwave burritos to celebrate. Sarah was a student who said to her sister, "I'm going to go to Cedar Point and find a parasite and name it after you." And sure enough, she did. Between the two of us, we couldn't get the genus name right, so it's in the wrong subfamily. But nevertheless, it's named Actinocephalus carolinii after Carolyn Richardson. So sure enough, here's someone. And that pond, I think, is no longer here. I haven't seen it in a while. It's Martin Bay Pond. So that's Sarah at the type locality, and Actinocephalus carolinii. Next one. This is Mike McCarty and Rick Goble. Both of them are now physicians. One of them, I think, is still in Hastings. That is the first Fundulus zebrinus that was observed to have parasites on it. And that really started 15, almost 20 years of research on the population and community dynamics of parasites in that species of fish. They came back, and one of those guys said to me, "Look at these gills. They have little white spots on them." So I knew immediately that those were mixozoans, and we made some slides. And and started doing a little project on the numbers of Mixozoan cysts on the gills, and that led to a whole variety of things. And so that is the fish that really started all that work. Next one. And that's Spindylus's brains. Next one. And this is Salsa Guy and his Falcon Eye. This is the one that's on the t-shirt that Gabe is wearing. And it's named for, again, for those of you who were not on the tour this afternoon, named for a gentleman by the name of Daryl Falcon, who gave us a key to his property, which is about 3 miles east of Roscoe, where we were at the bridge today. And in his honor, we named a parasite after him. Next one. This is simply the life cycle picture that we assembled to kind of help us think about all the various thesis projects that could be done with this particular system. Next one. This is one of the leopard frogs, and I mention this one primarily because of the next picture. And this, of course, many of you recognize as the paradigmatic. This is one of the icons of parasitology, the life cycle, in fact, the life cycle of a frog lung fluke. And this is probably Matalikas medial plexus, but feel free to correct me. What's happened as a result of research by students at Cedar Point, beginning with Scott Snyder and continuing with Matt, is that, first of all, the concept of the life cycle as an accurate picture in parasitism and parasitology in general has essentially been really called into question. And the sort of the visual literacy function of this diagram, this kind of diagram that is so familiar to all of us, I think has really been called into question. If you're a well-educated parasitologist, you know exactly, my pointer is acting up. If you're a well-educated parasitologist, you know exactly what this means. It means that you have 100 or so species of these things that are participating in these. You have a bunch of species of these. You have 4 or 5 species of these. You have at least 2 families of those. You have a really diverse set of ecological conditions under which they interact. And you get back really to Rich's running the bases metaphor then as an evolutionary scenario as opposed to something like a Red Queen battle between these worms and their host. But I think just simply by starting work on an icon and asking yourself, what really happens to this thing if you compare species? What really happens to this thing if you start comparing congeners and asking about how this life cycle is completed? And so that whole concept, that whole way of looking at parasites is really a product of kind of the white gate type thinking of Cedar Point students. Next one. Steve Knight, this begins a series of graduate students who showed up at Cedar Point. And for various reasons, Steve was from New Mexico State, actually came to work on Leishmania and ended up doing a bunch of stuff. He is now with USDA and doing very well. Next. Vince Connors, now a faculty member at one of the University of South Carolina campuses, showed up on our loading dock in a Pinto station wagon that he had rebuilt himself, leaking transmission fluid all over our loading dock, and came to be an ornithologist. And so, just by happenstance, I said, Vince, your car's leaking fluid all over our loading dock. He said, yeah, I've been putting a cord in it every couple hundred miles. So we went out there and discovered that it could be fixed with duct tape. And he was so appreciative that he stayed and took the parasitology class. And ended up then as one of Brent Nichols' doctoral students doing one of the most difficult and really challenging doctoral theses that I've ever watched be conducted my whole life on the costs of parasitism in acanthocephalans and birds. So this is Vince. Next. This is Janine Kyra, who was actually working for Mary Lou Pritchard and ended up being, she's a Ward Medalist on the faculty at University of Connecticut, repeated Pete Grants, travels the world studying tapeworms and sharks. Janine was, that in this particular picture, was teaching assistant in field Paraset. Next one. This is Ben Hanelt, who showed up here much like Rich Clopton, having decided that biology was more than pipetting clear fluids. And so Ben showed up and said, I'd like to work on horsehair worms. And so I said, okay, Ben, I'll make you a deal. If you can solve the life cycle in the first semester you're here, then we'll do it. And sure enough, he did it, and Cedar Point turned out to be a major part of his research activity, his research site. I think one of the reasons that doctoral students have shown up here and graduate students in general have shown up here at Cedar Point and at the University of Nebraska is because of the parasitologist's investment in the freshman courses and in finding people who really wanted to study parasites and who were willing to study parasites, ended up going to the meetings, going to the national meetings, going to the regional meetings, presenting the work, being good social encounter people, and getting across the idea that this place was a good place to come work, and especially this field station. Next one. And finally, a couple of the more recent ones. This is Laura Duclos, who's essentially a Brent Nichols' last doctoral student, and essentially an academic grandchild. She was sent here by Dennis Richardson, who was one of Brent's graduate students, doctoral students, who's now at Quinnipiac. This is Jacqueline Held, who was suggested, Nebraska was suggested to her by Larry Roberts, my co-author on Foundations of Parasitology. She was a varsity swimmer at Miami and decided she didn't want to go to med school. And so Larry said, go to Nebraska. Go to the field station. Next one. Postdocs, Isor Dumoron is now, between Isor and Vince, Connors are now married. Vince has become fluent in French. They had the translation contract for Claude Combs' book on parasite ecology, and here she is out in the field with Brett, a postdoc at the time. So we've had people all the way from freshman class to postdocs who have come out here to actually study parasitology. And this last summer, I know that there were at least three or four students who came with only freshman biology under their belts and did beautifully. And some of those are now working in research project, undergraduate honors thesis. Next one. Some class exercises in field Paraset. This is one out in the North Platte River where we are studying the biomass of black fly larvae attached to that rock and cutting them up and studying the biomass of myrmidon nematodes inside and doing the calculations, and ended up that if this river is like it is from here to the next 50 miles down to the city of North Platte, then there were 29 tons of those larvae in that river, parasitized by 8.3 tons of almost microscopic nematodes. So this kind of thing, this is the stuff that is so easy and to do and so readily available in a field program such as this one. Next one. One of the mock tropical disease exercises, they're in there hopefully collecting schistosomes, hopefully not getting swimmer's itch. Next. Typical Saining South Platte River. Next. Mosquito biology, when the season allows it and the year allows it and there's enough water, we do a tropical disease exercise on mosquitoes, and here they are collecting out in a flooded wheat field. Next. Creole mosquitoes down by the White Gate, we find them almost every year. It's always a revelation to students to see mosquitoes in these kinds of places. Next one. Students using one another as bait. Next one. The seining, the gill netting, the first year we were out here, the Gaiman Parks gill netted they were doing some fish studies. And that same year, Bill Current, who was a doctoral student in my lab, who was working on the relationship between Leishmania parasites and their host cells. He was a superb electron microscopist. And in about the middle of his doctoral dissertation, ready to start publishing some of it, folks from Rockefeller published that work, and so he just got scooped big time. And we were out at the field station about the time that happened, and I had pulled open some catfish gills. Sure enough, they were infected with Hinogaia, a myxozoan. So I cut off some of those gills and plopped them in glitter aldehyde, put them in the fridge, took them back to Bill. I said, Bill, here's a project you can work on. And a year and a half later, he had his PhD, and Bill Current then went to Auburn and is now at Eli Lilly, and he is an H.B. Ward medalist. Next. A woman named Blair Udale, I think only a parasitologist could have carried this off, because I've never seen any of our other faculty members exhibit any ability or willingness to do this. I got a call from the University Foundation who said, there is an unmarried lady who has property in Palo Alto, and she would like to come to the field station. So I said, fine, send her on out. And at the time, she was 70 years old, which is my age right now. And I thought, this woman is going to be a problem. And so my wife, Karen, is sitting back there in the back, got together a set of bedding and fixed her up a place in the cabin and all this stuff. And Blair came out and spent a week with us and went on all the field trips and had a superb time. Went swimming, diving off Monkey Rock up in Lake McConaughey. And then she came back a second year. At the end of her second visit, when I took her back to the airport at North Platte, she said, drive by the post office. I drove by the post office. She took this big envelope in, and she said, I've just sent instructions to my attorney to leave my house to the University of Nebraska. So she ended up with a reverse mortgage on it. So when she died, UNL Biology got about $300,000 from that sale, and that money helps fund some of the scholarships in biological sciences. I think the BioSci administration at the time probably took that money and put it in places that I would not have done it. The money belongs to Cedar Point. Those fellowships belong to Cedar Point. The endowment belongs to Cedar Point. And the fact that we have it means, as a result of parasitologists and parasitology students particularly, interacting with somebody they didn't have to interact with in any kind of a positive way. But the generosity, particularly of those students who made her feel welcome, who lived in the cabin with her, talked with her, took her swimming, took her to the bar, and are benefiting from her, you know, for years and decades afterwards. Next. One of the most exciting things that comes out of publicity is more publicity. And during the middle 80s, Mike Farrell, who's on the right, and Chris Lejak on the left, came to film one of my books. And here they are filming a scene over at the South Platte River. That particular one was my introduction into the movie industry. Actually, it was my second encounter with the movie industry, and both of them were highly educational. About the only thing I can say about it is, if you've ever dealt with the film industry, you will always watch the credits at the end of the film, no matter what, all the way through to the end. Here they are filming. Next slide. Here's a helicopter parked right out here. Instead of a machine gun, it had a camera. And so, yeah, I went out and got in that helicopter and we flew all over. So this is one of the interesting things that tends to happen when your field program is an exciting place to be and where students are talking about it all the time and where you're not afraid of the publicity involved. Next one. Typical Cedar Point class, there have been 33 of these. Next one. Actually, could we go back, Kristen? This? No, next one. No, go back. No, next one.
I got it.
Actually, Delaine, this is Leticia Plaisance.
There she is.
Yeah. So this is, we've had two or three students, foreign students, who have just simply written me and said, can we come work at Cedar Point? And I said, like an idiot, sure. So Leticia was one of them who showed up, and when she left, she said, "Do you think I can be a scientist?" And I said, "Well, I don't know. Keep trying." And sure enough, she has a PhD, and I think maybe even has a job. And spent time in Delane's lab as a postdoc, working on the evolution of monogenes in butterflyfish in Oceania. Next. This particular picture, a different class, but sort of expresses the field experience. This is one of the rental places downtown. Next one. Yeah, this was kind of the punchline. For those of you who may be following presidential politics, this is, you don't get it. So. So actually, this is the student who painted the scene that is above the fireplace up above. Cheryl Campbell, who also painted a picture, Sandhill's picture, that some of you may have seen in Dr. Nichols' office at some point or another. So we have that picture because at one point, a former graduate student and her boyfriend's current wife said, get that picture out of the house. So,
did she lose something?
Pardon me?
Did she lose something?
No, I think what that is. I don't know what that is. Yeah. This looks like a 22 caliber revolver or something, maybe. Next one. I think sort of the take-home lesson from this encounter out here with parasites and parasitologists and people who study parasites, all of those take-home lessons, there are two. One of them is that it doesn't really hurt to go to school and to do your intellectual endeavor in a place that is absolutely beautiful, as this one is. And this is a typical sunset over and over and over again. We see this kind of thing. But I think the other take-home lesson is that at least for those of us in higher education, your most reliable and dependable and most valuable resources walk in your front door every year by the thousands. And all you have to do is find a way to engage those people in the activities that are beneficial both to yourself and to them, and you're going to be successful. So that's really about all I have to say this evening. Y'all have been a great audience. I would be happy to answer any questions that you may have. Yes, Delane.
Brad, one of the things you said sort of struck or hit me, because same things happened at Idaho State University, and that's the fact that regular faculty, tenured faculty, are no longer in the classroom with freshman students. And I was just wondering, what do you think is the loss as far as that mind resource that University of Nebraska is going to experience with?
Question is, what's the loss when established senior faculty members are no longer in the introductory classroom? I think that this is my own take on it, and it may or may not be right, but from what I've seen in four decades plus in academia, the value of research is not in the overhead. The value, the function of research in higher ed is to keep your faculty trained. It's like practice on the football field. It's the cheapest, easiest, and most effective way to keep your faculty expert, to keep them alive intellectually. And so that's the fundamental role. And this feeling that the role of research is political and financial, that's all a byproduct, in my view. And so when the word research carries with it immunity from Bio 101, then that means that your most intellectually committed individuals, who really ought to be your most idealistic individuals, and if they are tenured, they are the freest individuals to develop those human resources, they're taken out of that opportunity. They're, the institution disconnects its most powerful means of sustaining itself from its most reliable and important resources to do just that. And I think over a 10-year period, you may come out ahead financially by hiring the big-ticket guys to go to NIH and hiring people from Radio Shack to teach 101. But that, you know, that doesn't pay off over the 25-year period.
Yeah. I just wonder how many of all these students you've answered would have never entered science in general. Yeah. How long was just Paris College? It wouldn't have been for the fact that
some faculty member felt secure enough to say, try this. Yeah. No, I don't know. But the answer is, and I don't know the number. What I do know is that the success rate from freshman recruit to faculty member at another university or a person in industry is about 1 out of every 800 or 1,000. Yeah. So that's the success rate.
One.
I would have done.
Sure.
I would have never had a reason here.
Well, Rich is 1 out of maybe 15,000 students I've given grades to. And there are about 15 of those students that I can personally remember that, you know, are now have advanced degrees because somebody talked to them. Yeah. Others? Y'all have been a great audience. I'm getting the cut it message, so thanks.